Now, navigating turbulent markets with Chris Ruschel on 1010XL.
Good morning, Jacksonville. This is Chris Ruschel. I'm a financial advisor here in Jacksonville, and I'm the managing principal of RFW Wealth Advisors. Not your normal criteria this morning as far as not going to do some sports and other things, but with financial markets kind of being a little sporty these days, we thought we'd join together with 1010XL and bring you folks of Jacksonville a little better understanding of what's going on out there and how to navigate these markets. Today on the show, I thought I'd take an opportunity to kind of bring you up to speed on how we got here. And really what's happening in financial markets. The virus is something that is exposing some issues and obviously creating an economic shock globally. But I thought I'd back up and kind of give you a little background and understanding a little bit more about what's going on, how we can navigate these markets together. So in the next, say, 3 to 5 weeks or maybe a little longer, depending on how long we stay in this stay-at-home order and markets are turbulent, we would bring the show to you. So again, we'll just kind of dive into some topics. If you miss any part of the show, you can always come on to 1010XL SoundCloud so that you can kind of, get any part that you may have missed if you're interested, because as I know, not everybody's going to be able to listen to the full show as you may be riding around this morning. Something important to kind of understand here is you've got a global economic shock because of the virus that is affecting a global economic system. So you've got Bretton Woods in 1944 literally created, a place where the U.S. essentially and the dollar started to dominate as a world reserve currency. Different countries used to clear in their own currencies, commodities like oil, and we all came under one global financial system in 1944. In the 70s, OPEC had been created in the 60s, but we effectively became under, we got off the gold standard in 1971, and in the 73 to 75 timeframe, OPEC really, formalized their whole strategy and managing their own supplies and oil, and that really created a petrodollar as the world's reserve currency at that point, because we were off the gold standard, we had a global system, and in order to buy oil, you first had to buy dollars. So since that time frame, pretty much after World War II, Japan, Western Europe, and the United States, our financial system has essentially dominated world markets. And now as we come into the 2000s, you've seen a lot of discourse with the dot-com bubble burst, you saw the 08 crisis and crash, and now we're having another economic shock. But signs of what was going on and why we've had so much liquidity in the system being injected by the Federal Reserve, that's something that's happening in an unprecedented way since 2008. And I think it's important to understand what central banks' impact have been so that, you can kind of really have a little bit of the history and an understanding of what's been driving markets since 2008. I pulled my little headset out here. Ultimately, in 2008, the crash, left our banks pretty well bankrupt to some degree. We consolidated a bunch of banks into the big, large global four banks, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, JP Morgan, et cetera, et cetera. And we had to recapitalize our banking. We also implemented a liquidity strategy called quantitative easing. What quantitative easing is where the Federal Reserve or a central bank will print money of their currency and then use that currency and printed money to effectively buy down the interest rates or create an artificial demand in buying our own debt. So you're monetizing your debt, and it's referred to as quantitative easing. When you get into looking at the last 10 years, central banks in Europe, the UK, and Japan, and the United States have effectively printed over $12 to $15 trillion at this point and injected that liquidity into the banking system. The liquidity has done a variety of different things, but predominantly what it's done is driven down the interest rate on the sovereign debts of the debt that they've been purchasing. What this ultimately does is it creates a low interest rate environment. throughout the yield curve of a country like ours is treasuries. So if you look at 30-year maturities, 10-year maturities, 20-year maturities, 5 years and such, they're artificially low. And that's in an environment where we've gone as a country from $8 trillion in debt in 2008 to over $22 trillion in debt today. We are witnessing a global super cycle of sovereign debt. And that's what's required all the central bank activity. So if you go back to 2016, and this is a global issue, you have, you know, the European Union, which is a monetary union but not a fiscal union in Europe, has a variety of member countries that came together in the late 90s and created the euro currency. And effectively, you know, it was an experiment. It's not something that they'd ever done before. And right now we're witnessing almost kind of a test as to whether the European Union is going to be able to sustain itself as a currency, in my opinion. We get to a place with these injections of liquidity that you have negative yielding debt throughout the world. It's not uncommon that, you know, you've got 12 to 15 trillion of printed money. You've got approaching those numbers in negative yielding debt in a variety of countries' sovereign debt around the world. That's kind of dangerous. Reinhard and Rogoff wrote a book explaining when you get into these huge amounts of debt, it slows economic growth. So we've been doing a variety of things, both with the Fed, things like tax cuts in recent years, to basically manipulate balance sheets to justify stock prices. So let me give you a little understanding that when you look at a stock market, what it's really doing is it's a discounting mechanism. Why you pay a price for a stock is based on its expected earnings. So if you look at the S&P, for example, those 500 companies have an expected earnings growth for the coming 12 to 18 months. And based on your ability to forecast what that is, you would pay a price for that stock based on its earnings, and that's called its P-E ratio. So the P-E ratio for the S&P 500 is considered average around 16. If the P-E ratio is higher than 16, you're paying, you know, you're kind of looking at a market that is somewhat considered overvalued. If you're paying under 16 on a P-E ratio, the market would be considered slightly undervalued. So obviously coming out of 2008, the stock market was very undervalued, and we threw trillions of liquidity. The Federal Reserve printed about $4 trillion here in the United States, and that was considered their balance sheet for quantitative easing. When you get into, 2016, you've got an environment in 2015 where the central bank in Europe started buying longer-term maturities, not just short-term maturities. And they were a little late to the party in doing so. But we were kind of done with our quantitative easing program in 2014. Now, that shifted over to Europe. And in 2016, you saw the UK, their citizens voted in a public referendum. They voted to effectively leave the EU. Now, they were never in the monetary union. They always maintained their own currency. But the country basically looked at all the debt, and many of you may remember the debt default risk of Greece and Spain and Portugal. But Italy was really the key country in regards to the amount of debt they have. They have more actual debt than any other country in Europe, except they had the third or fourth largest economy. So to have that much debt but only the third or fourth largest economy really doesn't make a lot of sense. So when you look at Greece, the contagion issue that people talked about when Greece was dealing with bailouts within the EU, it was really a math equation that you had to apply to the EU bailout of Greece that was considered a contagion. Because if you ever had to apply that math equation to the size of the Italian debt market, it would be much more of a problem for the EU to bail that out. Well, the UK citizens looked at that and said, you know, we expect that to be a problem down the road. So we don't want to be on the hook for paying for those bailouts as a country. Because how you bail stuff out is you tax the people, or you tax assets, or you tax businesses. And those business owners and taxpayers really looked at it and said, we don't want to be responsible for the future of bailing out of Europe, and specifically Italy. So they voted to leave the EU. And why I bring that up is you're going to be sitting here watching Italy after their shutdown effectively, you know, potentially start a banking crisis in Europe that could spread throughout Europe because they're all intermingled. That then could obviously affect the globe. So we're going to have to see, you know, where that develops once we come out of this lockdown situation in Europe. January 31st of this year is when Brexit took place. And much of the news was talking about Brexit in a sense of, are we going to get a hard Brexit? Are we going to get a new vote to remove Brexit? What effectively does that mean? Well, Brexit with a deal was basically Brexit with an alimony payment. So we'll end up talking a little bit more about this, but we'll go to break. But let's definitely come back to the whole Brexit issue when we get back from break. Hey, folks, welcome back to Navigating Turbulent Markets with Chris Rochelle from RFW Wealth Advisors. We were discussing Brexit a little bit before the break, but let me get a disclosure out here before we move forward. Discussions on this show should not be considered as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult your own investment professional before making any investment decisions. Securities through RFW Wealth Advisors are offered through Cambridge Investment Research, a registered broker-dealer member of FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors, a registered investment advisor. So again, RFW Wealth Advisors is not affiliated with Cambridge, but that's the broker-dealer that we clear through. Again, kind of coming back to the Brexit discussion that we were talking about before we went to break. That's been an ongoing, they voted in 2016 to do it, but it's been an ongoing negotiation really since Theresa May, their prime minister, invoked the article to start a two-year time clock. That two-year time clock has been wrought with a lot of back and forth as to whether it was even going to happen, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously, it's sometimes, you know, when you negotiate an exit deal from the EU, it was kind of a punishment deal. So, you know, you're going to be set up with costs and issues that are negative for your economy to leave the EU is really what was the negotiation. And it got really complicated. So I guess I try to explain quantitative easing and the fact that we've done all this stimulus is really based on John Maynard Keynes's economics, is when there's no buyer in the market. There's what happens when you don't have enough buyers and you have forced sellers of any security. The bid and the ask spread, in other words, the price differential between the bid and the ask starts to widen. And that's what starts to show up as a sign of illiquidity in the marketplace. You have more sellers than buyers. So Keynes's, you know, economics basically said the government or the Federal Reserve has to be the buyer of last resorts in times of panic. And we're obviously experiencing one of those right now. And you've seen incredible programs as far as dollar amounts that are injected and stimulus bills and bailouts and things that we're all hearing in the news. But when did this really start? If you think about it, in 2008, it took us almost a year and a half to get to a TARP bailout vote in Congress. This took 3 weeks. It's kind of amazing to think about how unprecedented that you could spend a $2.2 trillion stimulus bill when we're already running trillion-dollar deficits in our taxation and our budget as far as the money that the country spends. So you're likely to see a $3 trillion deficit budget this year. You go back to fall of 2015, the federal balance sheet of the Federal Reserve was somewhere in the neighborhood of about $4.5 trillion. And the previous administration's, Jerome Powell, the current Fed chair, was a lady named Janet Yellen. And Janet basically said that they were going to start to raise interest rates from this zero interest rate policy that we'd been under for about 5 or 6 years. Which was artificially low. And you only do that in times of you know, real economic strife. But we've been there for 10 years. So they said they were going to start to try and normalize interest rates and potentially reduce the balance sheet. So Fed Chair Powell, under the new administration, was voted in as Fed Chair and approved by Congress. And in January of 18, he actually, after a year of rate hikes, each quarter there was a quarter point rate hike. And that was an attempt to get back to normalization. The Fed rate was somewhere around 4.5% to 5% back before 2008, and it had been at zero for years. So we started to raise rates. We got to about 2.25%, 2.5%, in the Fed funds rate throughout 2018. But what was interesting is they basically said they were going to start to allow the balance sheet to shrink. And that's kind of quantitative tightening. So you're not just raising interest rates, you're also reducing the money supply at the same time. And Fed Chair Powell basically told Congress that their idea was to reduce the balance sheet by about almost $2 trillion over the next 18 months. They were just going to allow the maturity or the investments or the treasuries that they bought to mature. And that would reduce the money supply. In 2018, if you remember, in January, there was a huge shock and a quick downdraft in the market, which then, you know, it was kind of the shock of the news. But really what it was unwinding a leverage trade that was shorting volatility derivative investments and double long the S&P 500. There was kind of a hedge fund trade or an institutional trade out there. And so announcing that they were going to reduce the balance sheet really set in motion this trade unwind. And then throughout the rest of the year, we continued to kind of stay on the autopilot. But by fall, you had the Brexit date of the end of the two-year clock coming up in March of 2019. And what the Fed noticed was is that there was a lack of liquidity in what's called the repo market. The repo market is where treasuries actually get turned into cash, physical cash. And the banks were not stepping up to cash out those treasuries, and there was starting to be a liquidity issue. And I think personally that the liquidity issue was banks in Europe and global banks that are all interconnected were preparing for Brexit and what it meant. And you were coming to the end of the time clock. So were you going to get a hard Brexit where immediately the UK stopped funding the EU? Or were you going to get a deal with Brexit, which would have some kind of an alimony payment, which the EU was asking for a two-year alimony payment? We're talking, you know, almost 5.6 billion euros a quarter is what the contribution rate was for the UK into the EU. So banks really started to prepare for this issue, and banks in Europe started to want more diversification outside of just pound or euro dollar based. They wanted to own dollar based investments instead of just EU. They wanted to diversify their reserve holdings. So that created a run on the dollar and a run on real cash in our system. So this was already happening before the virus. And ultimately, when you get the virus, sorry, I'm keep pulling my jack out. But when you get the virus, it's a huge economic shock. But if you go back to October of last year, the Federal Reserve had already started another quantitative easing program because you were still coming up to this hard Brexit issue as a date at the end of October. So they noticed the same thing. And instead of this time seeing the liquidity and kind of the market reaction that we saw in around December of 18, they decided to go ahead and fire up a liquidity injection and start expanding the balance sheet again. So effectively refiring a mini quantitative easing. In doing so, it provided liquidity to the market, but it also then sent the market on a stock market, you know, growth of the market started to really climb quickly. And you didn't get a ton of growth in 2019, but the stock market performed very well. And a lot of it was towards the end of the year when this liquidity started to be injected again, because the game was as long as the Federal Reserve was printing money and putting it in the system, that was good for propping up stocks. So you come to the end of the year, you didn't get a lot of earnings growth. GDP has been, you know, kind of low for the last decade. Normally, after a recession like 08, you would get 5-6% escape velocity type growth in the GDP. We've really pretty much averaged around 2%. After the tax law changes, that was a little bit of a kicker and gave companies an extra way to manipulate their balance sheet and drop more to their earnings to the bottom line, thus justifying higher stock prices just because they were paying less taxes. And they used a lot of that money to buy back their stock, a lot of the big companies, which also reduced shares. So if you're reducing supply and you're also adding dollars to the bottom line, it justifies higher stock prices. So, you know, we had all the trade tariff wars, we had the impeachment stuff last year. So a lot of that left things very unsure. The global economy was somewhat slowing down because China wasn't doing as well. And we were resolving those trade issues towards the end of the year was the expectation. So we were seeing an expansion in PE ratios. In other words, earnings weren't going up, but we were justified paying higher prices for stocks simply because interest rates were so low in bonds. So on a relative basis, it makes stocks look cheaper, just simply because you can't get an interest rate in a money market or anything like that as far as a safe investment. So the dividend rate on the S&P 500 was actually starting to be higher than the Treasury yield. And so that was all being created by this demand coming out of Europe for dollar-based assets. And so that's why the Fed had to fire up the liquidity, but they also in 2019 cut rates three times. They actually did a complete 180 on what they said they were going to do at the end of 18. They were, you know, pretty much going to raise rates a quarter point a quarter and allow the balance sheet to shrink. Within a month at the end of 2018, they basically said they were reversing course completely. And again, I think it's all this coming up to Brexit that was causing this liquidity crunch. So you get into this year, and we had a lot of good news. The markets were still moving along fine. Employment was doing great. We were at record lows. And pretty much the GDP did start to pick back up towards the end of the year. In the first quarter of this year, it was higher than it was expected to be. And we were getting excited on the fact that we were resolving trade tensions with China. Congress had passed the new trade agreements between the United States, Mexico, and Canada. And, you know, it's an election year, so you're not going to get anything really crazy out of Congress. But this virus really exposes because it's an economic shock. I mean, it's always something you don't see coming, right? So in 2008, it was the mortgage crisis. In 2001, it was things around dot-com bubble bursts. I have some arguments if those were really what the causes of that were. But at the end of the day, you get into this virus situation and all of a sudden China is in lockdown. And what you have is the average human being or the average U.S. citizen, 40% of them have less than $400 in their bank account. So they're living paycheck to paycheck. But effectively, so are companies. So are governments and other institutions. And, you know, I heard the phrase, you know, why are companies not better prepared for these situations when they pop up? And it's because when the Federal Reserve announces programs like that, you kind of create a moral obligation or a moral hazard, if you will, that people start to expect it. So everything's running kind of, you know, on the edge a little bit, if you will. We've had higher P.E. ratios. They were around 18, 19 as we rolled into the beginning of this year. Higher than average, so somewhat overvalued, but not necessarily relative to interest rates was the argument. And we get into starting to have this virus have an effect. And really what it had the biggest effect on first was oil markets. You started to see a lower demand for oil and oil prices started to fall as China and then South Korea and other countries in Asia shut down. That's, you know, that's a big deal. So you start to get into these intense negotiations with countries like Russia and Saudi Arabia and other and Iran, where really their entire country is operating off of the price of oil. And that's how they pay their bills. So oil prices starting to drop, that affects them, you know, quite a bit. So you could say that Russia and Saudi Arabia got into a bit of a who's got a bigger one? Who can outlast the other as far as falling oil prices? And instead of cutting oil prices, they both actually agreed to increase, or not really agreed, they did this in spite of each other, to try and drive oil prices down. I personally think that Russia is after that to get some sanctions relief. But what it then caused with this global petrodollar-based world reserve currency, it created a huge supply shock. You know, you've got way more supply, you've got falling demand, and then they're going to increase supply. So that caused oil prices to go from $40 to $20 in a matter of about five trading days. That is a huge, huge big deal because it shuts down U.S. oil shale operations. And those companies got to make money, but they can't make money at that price. So there's lots and lots of loans out there and BDCs and mortgage REITs and senior floating rate funds. These rates, these interest rates on these things, they can't really roll their debt. So they start to have a problem. And that's a problem then to whoever lent them money. So we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get back. Again, you're with 1010XL, Chris Rochelle, Navigating Turbulent Markets, and we'll continue when we come back. Welcome back to Navigating Turbulent Markets with Chris Rochelle with RFW Wealth Advisors. We are again here on 1010XL talking a little bit about finance for you this morning and navigating these issues. So when we left off, we were talking a little bit about kind of where we are and how we got here. But again, let me get a little disclosure out of the way. Discussions on this show are not could be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your own investment professional before making any investment decisions. Securities through RFW Wealth Advisors are offered through Cambridge Investment Research, a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors, which is a registered investment advisor. Again, RFW Wealth Advisors in Cambridge, my broker-dealer, are not affiliated companies. When we left off, we were basically kind of arriving to this point of this huge economic shock. So we're now in a state of stay-at-home order. Some things I think we need to be thinking about is that China really locked down their economy, their you know, entire people in a way that as a country I think is different than what happened in Europe and what's happened so far in the United States. China is communist. You tell people in China to stay home and they stay home. You tell people in Jacksonville, Florida, stay home, close one beach, they go to another beach until you've not really seen a coordinated stay-at-home order on a national basis. Same thing in Europe. It's just hard to get a democratic society to truly follow those orders as this virus spreads. But we're now there, I feel, at least in Jacksonville. Obviously, we've now come under a stay-at-home order. And I do want to give a shout out to all of our medical professionals out there that are out there taking care of us and really putting themselves in harm's way as a part of doing their duty, if you will. And then everybody else that's staying at work in this time of crisis. You got kids at home. You got a lot of disruption, and that disruption is also going on in the financial system. So let's talk a little bit about some of the programs that have been brought over the last, say, 3 or 4 weeks from both the Federal Reserve and the stimulus bill, the CARE Act. You have seen unprecedented, even from the 2008 levels that were just, you know, again, $4.5 trillion on the federal balance sheet of dollars that had been printed, you know, on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet to inject in liquidity. We tried to unwind maybe $1 trillion worth of liquidity in 2018, and that caused, again, a liquidity crisis. We could not normalize rates. So we've backpedaled rates back down to zero, and we're back to the printing presses again. The Federal Reserve has announced $1.5 trillion to the Fed swap program. That's really foreign demand for dollars coming out of Europe and Asia, looking to diversify their reserve holdings. They have taken bank reserves for most regional banks to zero, effectively undoing the capital ratio increases required by Dodd-Frank back after the crisis of 08. That was an act that re-regulated our financial, especially our banks. Europe's got their own version of it called Basel III. But adhering to the rules of Dodd-Frank and the amount of treasuries that are on the balance sheets of these banks, you know, we talk about toxic assets that were on the bank's balance sheets in the form of mortgages that were going bust. Back when we did TARP, that was Toxic Asset Relief Program. Well, I think we have to effectively look at it and realize the outcome of sustaining liquidity and not being able to draw it back out of the market and Dodd-Frank were actually now causing part of the liquidity crisis to happen. You know, where you're seeing the bid spread acts of the repo market, the corporate bond market, municipal bonds that are somewhat considered government guaranteed. These bonds were starting to price below par, and that's where you start to get a little nervous. So you had the $1.5 trillion that was really meant for more the Fed swap program, the dollar-based swap for foreign currency exchange. And then we announced, you know, another $700 billion that they were going to put into action on the quantitative easing. So when you're buying repo assets, you're buying very short-term maturities. But the next program that they announced when they took bank reserves down to zero for regional banks, the reason for doing that is that so that lines of credit aren't closed by banks. They don't start to look at the risk of their balance sheet and reduce, you know, they're mandating business to basically shut down. They don't want the banks pulling their lines of credit, forcing them into bankruptcy. So they agreed, you know, to provide liquidity. Then they agreed to take reserve requirements for those regional banks down to zero. And then they added another $700 billion quantitative easing program. That's a lot of liquidity at one time, but it still wasn't really having the effect that they wanted to. So last Monday, basically, still continuing to see this deal, they backed fully municipal bonds and corporate bonds. They effectively got rid of the risk of overnight funding for banks. Banking in and of itself no longer has a risk. So when banks were hoarding their own real physical cash and not wanting to you know, cash out corporate bonds and money markets, as well as act in the repo market to cash out treasuries, they were hoarding their own cash. And the Fed basically said, on a short-term basis, you have unlimited access to the Fed window. We will give you all the money you need. So at that point, pretty much the Federal Reserve has not just thrown the kitchen sink at this thing. They've also thrown maybe half the neighborhood, if you will, at it from a liquidity standpoint. Bank of Japan is kind of standing by. I don't think their Federal Reserve really, or their central bank really, has an opportunity to do much more. They've been in a state of economic malaise for the better part of 20, 30 years. Europe has fired up their own version of quantitative easing again to try and keep interest rates from blowing out over there with the crisis they're dealing with. Because if you got a blowout of Italian debt interest rates, you'd have a real problem on your hands. So central banks have done what they've done in the past with these crises. They've just thrown as much liquidity at it as they can. Now the government has stepped in with the $2.2 trillion stimulus bill. And I really want people to kind of understand this is kind of cartoon math. We're throwing trillions and trillions of dollars around like it's nothing. And $1 trillion is a heck of a lot of money. It's a million millions. It's 1,000 billions. It's a lot of, it's a big number. And now we're not just doing $1 trillion bailout packages. We're doing 2, 3, 4, 5 trillion. You see, here and there. That's kind of unnerving. But as long as all of this is a short-term issue and we don't end up having a rolling outbreak of the virus across the country and it keeps popping up to where we have to stay under this lockdown, stay-at-home order, we can come out of it. And I'm highlighting those numbers simply because they're huge. So if we come out of this and go back and fire back up the economy quickly, you could easily see stock prices, recover fast. So this is a rough time to be trying to trade the markets. You want to work with your investment professionals and understand your risk tolerances and your time frames and make sure you got some level of liquidity if you're retired for your income needs. But it's a tough time to be trying to figure out exactly, the timing of anything. So in subsequent shows, we're gonna have some additional guests and we're gonna talk to you a little bit more in detail about programs like the CARE Act, the SBA lending program. I'd like to get in some of the lenders out there, but that program really just fired up last Friday, and they're still ironing out the details as exactly what these programs are going to do and how that money's going to get out to folks. They're sending out $1,200 to the folks under $75,000 in income for individuals. I believe it's like $110,000 for married couples. But, that'll get money in people's hands, at least for the short run, and they've even said they may do a couple of those checks if needed, depending on how long we stay in this environment. I personally believe that this is maybe going to go a little longer than just, say, weeks or a month. I think you have to look to Europe, and when they're canceling things, like in Japan, the Olympics that were set for July, they're canceling the British Open, they're canceling Wimbledon. Those are June and July dates. I really think as a country and as individuals, you've got to think that this is at least going to take 2 to 3 months. China, it took them around 3 months to really, sequester the population and kind of the distancing and getting to where the spread rate slowed drastically so that they could open back up. We've yet to truly lock down, if you will, the way China did, and Europe is kind of ahead of us. So we can look to Europe to kind of, go, okay, how long is this going to be? Is this going to be another month? Is this going to be another 2 months? God forbid, 2, 3, 4 months. But that's the risk. So you saw an initial shock of the stock market dropped as much as 34%, but then it bounced back up on the announcement of a lot of these liquidity deals and stimulus checks that are going to come out to small businesses. If we can, do our part and stay home and truly stop the spread of the virus, we can get back to work, we can get the economy going again. And with all the stimulus that has been shoved into the system, the hope is that would be a very quick rebound, or what's called a V bottom. And it would, you know, it went down really quick. It could come back really quick. Right now, the market's down, I guess, about 26, 27%. The risk would be if we don't have a V recovery, the virus lingers longer. And I'm not a doctor, you know, I'm doing the best I can to navigate financial markets, but I'm definitely not a doctor. But if this were to be rolling breakouts in different cities across the country and we're kind of unlocking, locking down, that would be really nasty for the recovery rate of the economy. And that's where you start to worry about, is it more like a U recovery? In other words, you go down, you stay down for maybe 4, 5, 6 months, and then we ramp back up the economy. The worst case scenario would be a hockey stick or an L. That's really when you're talking about a prolonged economic downturn and depressionary style, you know, timeframes. That risk is real. I mean, I think we have to accept that, depending on how long, you know, this virus is affecting us. And then how long can these liquidity measures, you know, take hold? Did they lose effect? You know, we really were firing ammunition at this with a half-loaded gun in regards to what the ammunition the Federal Reserve had, because we weren't able to normalize rates. We weren't able to shrink the balance sheet, and Europe didn't even try. So, you know, I do think Europe's in for a little bit more of a harder slug. From an investment standpoint, I think Asia, as it comes back online, you may see, you know, Asian markets actually start to perform better. And, you know, hopefully we get that kind of an outcome where it's only a 2-3 month cycle versus a longer cycle. So we're going to take a break here again and come back and kind of summarize the show and what we're going to be talking about in the future. But I just wanted to kind of give everybody a little background as to how we got here and what the real risks are. But understanding the massive amount of liquidity and programs that the government has put in place here to backstop the economy while we're on this shutdown. So, again, hang on for a break here and come back to us at 1010XL after the break. Welcome back to 1010XL, your navigating turbulent markets with Chris Rochelle. I'm a financial advisor and managing principal with RFW Wealth Advisors here in Jacksonville. Just kind of want to wrap up a little bit. I think, folks, we're going to see some really turbulent times here over the next, say, 4 to 6 weeks. And hopefully during that time, we'll be back each Saturday for the foreseeable future and just bring in some different folks from different perspectives. Paul Black is a CPA that operates out of our offices and works with a lot of our clients. I plan on having him in. The CARE Act has a lot of different tax implications and ways to access retirement accounts. We'll talk a little bit about that, you know, without the tax penalties and things that we're typically used to. So the CARE Act does have some tax implications. I'll have Paul here to discuss that with you. We've got real estate professionals in our office, as well as friends in the mortgage business. We'll probably be bringing in some folks from Future Home Loans. And Jackie Ward is a real estate broker that works out of our offices and works with our clients, because I know a lot of my clients are wanting to know about how to access low rates and considering refinancing their homes in this environment. And there's been a bit of a backlog with some of the liquidity issues. One of the things the Federal Reserve is buying are mortgage-backed securities, and hopefully that will speed up the refi process, because a lot of people want to access lower rates to refinance mortgages and other debts. I do plan to try and bring in some folks and talk about the SBA programs that are bailouts for small business owners, or cash just to kind of help you through the times. Those programs look to be getting underway. I expect that to be a bit of a slow process here out of the gate, but Secretary Mnuchin has even said, you know, the $350 billion that they dedicated to that bailout program for small business owners, they would ask Congress for more money should that first come first serve program run out. So I think you can expect to see additional action out of the administration and Congress. I think they do realize this is going to take longer at this point than just a few weeks. This is going to be a prolonged stay-at-home situation. And for, you know, the average individual out there that doesn't have a lot of money, I hope they get the checks out to you soon. For those small business owners, hang on. Contact your local banker. These programs are going to provide some significant benefits as far as helping you through this rough time, so that hopefully we don't have to let go of our employees and we can keep people employed during this period. And then just, you know, Jacksonville, stay calm, stay patient, you know, navigate this together, and hopefully that'll be a shorter window of time that we stay under this this stay-at-home order. And then we can get back to life as normal. And again, thank you very much to all the professionals in the health community that are out there, you know, keeping us safe, and our government officials that are just doing the best they can. I'm not necessarily a huge Republican or Democrat. I think right now it's important that we all get on the same page and do what's right for our citizens. If we're going to force us into this stay-at-home situation and create such a huge shock to our economy, I'm glad to see that you know, our folks are doing the best they can. So let's pray for our leaders, and let's pray for our neighbors, and pray for our families, and stay healthy, Jacksonville. It's a rough time for us to all go through, I know. So in future weeks, I'll be back, like I said, with some guests, and you know, we'll continue to try and help you navigate these times. Today, I tried to give you a little bit of a background on some things, and in coming weeks, we'll talk a little bit more about strategies and things you can consider for your own investments. And I look forward to speaking to you again next Saturday.